to Kingston Real Estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
CFRC from Kingston, Ontario. Your volunteer program, campus and community radio at 101.9 FM and on the web at cfrc.ca.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. After a highly anticipated court ruling last week, the City of Kingston is moving forward with the purchase of the property at 2000 Front Road, known to many as Lemoyne Point Farm. The acquisition follows a court-approved settlement reached after years of confidential negotiations related to the property. The city purchased the approximately 80-acre site for $12 million. Jim Biaggi, Chris Cannon, Sheila Mirsky, and Richard Rayburn Gibson of the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group, a coalition of Kingston residents who have long advocated for the protection of the land, sat down with CFRC to share their history with the property and their thoughts on this latest development.
Jim Biaggi, and I'm with the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group, which I've been with since its inception.
So I'm Chris Cannon, and there were seven of us who got together right after Mary Fraser died, realizing that the Lemoyne Point Farm might be under pressure of development, and we formed the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group and have since evolved. But Sheila and I had a long history back 35, 36 years ago of back when Lemoyne Point Farm was in Kingston Township. There was pressure to develop 22, 23 acres corner of the farm and build houses and extend sewers, et cetera, et cetera. And we long fought that. Sheila was the head of our Protect Lemoyne Point organization that formed. And I should turn it over to Sheila, but just to say that we would attract 500 people at public meetings in township offices to protect Lemoyne Point from this development.
Hi, I'm Sheila Mirsky, yes. So I was one of many people who have been involved with trying to protect Lemoyne Point Farm for, 36 years. It was really heartwarming to see how much the communities wanted that land protected. I mean, back before the internet and before email and all that technology, we were able to get together a petition with 6,000 signatures to present to the then Township Council of Kingston. And we influenced a municipal election result, actually, to keep that development from occurring way back then. So it was a long-standing desire of the community to see that land not turn into a subdivision and to have it remain natural. And ultimately, we were hoping that there could be a public purchase.
Almost an original member of the group, and been with them since that same period of time, 2022. And as you know from our website and your previous research, our goal to conserve the field, forest, and shoreline of Lemoyne Point Farm for future generations. The group that Chris mentioned and others have mentioned, that it includes seven people, is a really spectacular group of talented people that have been doing advocacy work to protect this property.
Thank you all for that background. And again, there's a long history here. After all these years of discussion and advocacy, what does this ruling feel like?
Well, we really think it is good news, and we applaud the city for their persistence in negotiating this purchase of the farm. over, you know, they've been involved in this for quite some time, and we've been in contact with them, you know, with the politicians, the mayor's office, councillors, senior staff, legal department, you know, for a couple of years as these negotiations have been underway. So it is a remarkable and important milestone that they have finalized the negotiation of this process through the hearing process and so on. And it's an important investment in one of the few remaining natural spaces within the urban boundary of Kingston. And Chris has already talked about how this is, you know, so important in terms of preserving this special place, this jewel on Lake Ontario. You know, we're pleased with this step, but, you know, we're going to be vigilant in the future to make sure that, you know, our objectives and our objectives in terms of the local and regional community are met.
I'll just echo Richard, and we've worked long and hard, and me and Sheila for 36 years to make sure that it remained an open natural space with public access, and this is a step towards that.
Really, really over the moon that this purchase has happened, and we can now work positively with the community and the city to see that it's properly protected in the long term.
Looking ahead, according to a statement released by the city, the land will remain open to the public and protected while long-term plans are developed with community input. More detailed information is expected to be included in a council report scheduled for March 24th, 2026. The Save Le Moyne Point Farm Group says they plan to continue their advocacy and remain vigilant to ensure the farm's long-term protection.
Yeah, I think we're most concerned about what the process will be to ensure that this this property does remain protected in the long term. As you know, councils change every 4 years, and the future council could easily decide to rezone and sell off part of that property. So that's why I think Richard mentioned that we need to remain engaged and vigilant. But I'm confident that the community is so much in favor of having that remain natural space that I don't think that there's going to be that will ever happen, but we want to not have to remain on guard all the time and see if we can put in place something that will ensure that that could not happen.
Just one more layer on that as well is that Mary Fraser, who was the owner of the farm at the time she died, had long wanted the farm to be public space and not be developed, and had those expressed as wishes in her last will and testament. So I feel we're honoring Mary's wishes as well if we are endeavoring to keep it a natural space and keep it on a farm and the forests from development.
And moving forward, what kinds of safeguards are you maybe hoping get put in place? Like you guys said, we're almost at the end of this council term. There's going to be lots of changeover in the future. What are some of the measures that you think should be put in place to keep this space safe?
You know, we have looked at legal techniques in the past. One scenario that we've looked at was conservation easements, and this is where you put a registered on title document on file that limits future use, and there could be specifications in that conservation easement. As Sheila says, local councils change, and, you know, 10 years might sound like a long time, not to worry, but we're thinking about generations from now and having this place remain a natural area, and protected, these fields and these forests and this unique, very unique shoreline. You know, not until 2040, but, you know, beyond the turn of the century and so on. So to have a robust system in place that can be resilient against the puts and takes of politics and economics and everything else needs some protections in place that might be legal documents or other things.
And we must remember the indigenous practice of always looking seven generations ahead as you plan. I hope we will continue to do that.
The city has also indicated it will pursue partnerships with organizations such as the Cataraqui Region Conservation Authority and other not-for-profit groups. In the city's statement, Mayor Brian Patterson said these partnerships will help ensure the property remains a welcoming and sustainable space, adding that the city looks forward to working with residents to imagine the future of Lemoyne Point Farm.
I think when we talk about how unique and magnificent this gem of a property is, I think the word imagine is really important. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, a generational opportunity to save this property and dream and imagine about, a future in which this type of property exists decades and longer from now. So I may be sounding a little altruistic here, but to encourage Kingstonians and others to imagine that that future is something I'd like to see out of the consultation.
Thanks, Richard. That's a very positive way of putting it, and I agree. And we had a community meeting. When was that? 2 years ago, I guess, where there was a visioning exercise of how, for people to imagine how the property might be used in public space, and that information's on our website. But I think for the city to undertake something like that, that would get people's minds churning about what might be done with the space, would be wonderful.
As Kingston begins to imagine what comes next for the farm, the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group says they will continue their work, also pointing to the importance of the upcoming municipal elections as a key moment for advocacy and accountability.
The broader agenda of vigilance and looking at approaches to ensure long-term preservation, but drilling down a little bit, it might be to participate in a consultation that might be happening that the city runs. We will continue to be in contact with our broad base of supporters across Kingston and maybe seek additional advice from them. We are working with an organization called Small Change Fund, and through that have had the ability to receive charitable donations. So we have some funds, and if there's opportunities to hire subject matter experts or others to support the community's work on the future of the farm, we can do that. We'll certainly continue to be active with our newsletter and on social media, keeping people informed. And I think also, we have met, as I said, with politicians and senior staff at the city. We will continue to do that, make sure they're aware of our vision for this property. And, it won't be too many months before we might decide we want to pay attention to who's running for municipal council and mayor and see what they're saying about their agenda.
Just to add to what Richard said about reaching out to our local politicians with the elections expected in November and uncertainty around mayoral candidates. At the previous election cycle, we were quite successful reaching out to mayor and councillors and from almost all of those people getting commitments that the farm should be protected from development. So we are likely to be engaging in a campaign during the summer and fall to get commitments again from people running again for council or mayor's positions.
Council has unanimously approved $3 million in funding for the development of Tricolor Labs, a shared industry-ready wet lab and biomanufacturing facility planned for Botterill Hall at Queen's University. Ben McGillwam with Kingston Economic Development Corporation spoke to the demand for the facility and the benefit of having it in Kingston.
So the primary users of the lab are going to be fully funded commercializing stage life sciences companies looking for lab space, spinouts from the university and the college, and then other regional spinouts looking for BSL2 lab space. and scaling life science companies within the region, looking for short-term leases anywhere from 10 weeks to over a year. And then foreign direct investments, looking for lab space to enter the North American market, kind of hitting the ground running. Tricolor Labs, addresses a clear market demand across Ontario. There's a lack of wet lab space, especially the BSL-2 for companies. And Kingston in particular has a severe lack of this space. The Tricolor Labs will integrate quite well with the Kingston ecosystem. The strengths that are Queen's University, the biotech program that's at St. Lawrence College, and the city's vision for a long-term health campus around a new hospital. This will be a feeder to that space. Kingston has a strong area of research and early stage innovation in the life sciences. We have programs like Dun & Desponsay's Queen's Innovation, a build-to-scale life science program where we see companies spinning out IP from the university into new businesses. Leveraging the research strengths that's at Queen's University and a lot of the equipment that is there that life science companies want.
Jesse Coobs with Economic Development at Queen's University also spoke before council to how Queen's is uniquely positioned to meet this demand for lab space.
Queen's University is uniquely positioned to host Tricolor Labs. It has established programs and offers entrepreneurial and IP support necessary for early stage companies. The campus has established BSL 1 and 2 wet lab infrastructure, specialized equipment, and full biosafety and waste management framework already in place. It also has state-of-the-art animal facilities that help bridge the preclinical gap that often exists for startups. And importantly, Queen leads numerous clinical trials locally and internationally, meaning companies have the ability to plug directly into clinical research pathways as well. The eighth floor of Bottle Hall provides an ideal foundation for Tricolor Labs' footprint. It already contains existing BSL 1 and 2 wet lab space, autoclaves, fume hoods, waste systems, all connected by secure card access hallways. The vision is to update and modernize the existing space into flexible modular suites similar to smart labs style facilities that are in global innovation centers, enabling multiple firms to collate safely with direct access to Queen's core facilities. Second floor is another area that's been designated with an open concept layout, growth-friendly space, ideal for companies looking for collaborative and scalable workspace. Shared equipment that is essential that would be cost prohibitive for companies, but it allow companies to grow and collaborate.
McIlwain and Coobs were given another opportunity to highlight the university's unique positioning for this project when asked by council how much this project would cost without the existing infrastructure at Queen's.
So I think the ballpark of that would be around $1,500 a square foot. Just to renovate it was over $1,000 a square foot, plus the planning and permitting, and then finding the space that would fit the needs.
I'll just add quickly, to set up a biosafety level 2 building without the infrastructure would be millions and millions of dollars. The opportunity here is that we'll leverage existing infrastructure that is multi-million dollars of equipment and already established programs that we can leverage.
The funding is conditional on securing and maintaining additional government funding, finalizing governance and oversight structures, and executing formal funding and collaboration agreements between the City of Kingston, Kingston Economic Development Corporation, and Queen's University. The city's contribution will be limited to capital and equipment costs only, with no responsibility for operating, maintenance, or life cycle expenses. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Hello, you are listening to your Queen's Campus Beat here on CFRC 101.9 FM or online at cfrc.ca. Health authorities are alerting students and residents following a confirmed case of measles in the Kingston area. Southeast Public Health has identified 3 locations where potential exposure may have occurred between February 9th and February 13th, including Queen's University's Kingston Hall at 103 Stewart Street on Tuesday, February 10th, from 11:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Additional exposure sites were Good Life Fitness at 64 Barrack Street and the Metro Grocery Store at 310 Berry Street. Public health officials stressed that measles is highly contagious and individuals exposed should check their vaccination records, monitor for symptoms like fever, rash, and conjunctivitis, and isolate if necessary. Additionally, seek medical attention. Students unsure of their immunization status are advised to consult health services or their healthcare provider promptly. On campus, Queen's Relay for Life is ramping up for its 20th anniversary fundraising campaign. The Relay, a 12-hour walkathon supporting the Canadian Cancer Society, is scheduled for March 20th in the Queen's Athletic and Recreation Center, the ARC. This year's organizers have an ambitious 170,000 fundraising goal with more than 550 participants already registered and over $65,000 already raised ahead of the event. Funds raised support cancer research and services for survivors and families in Kingston and beyond. Past events have involved hundreds of students, faculty, and community partners. In recent Queen's faculty, staff, and employee news, recent internal reporting from Queen's University shows that just over half of all employees, around 51%, participated in the university's latest employee experiences survey, conducted in early 2026. The survey, administered by the external research firm Metrics at Work, was designed to measure faculty and staff engagement across key areas such as communication, workplace clarity, recognition, and support for mental health. Principal Patrick Dean thanked the participants, noting the results will provide valuable information to help shape positive and productive organizational culture. Aggregated findings will be released in the coming months, with anonymized faculty-level results also shared to guide future planning. On a broader Kingston front, the 2026 Mayor's Innovation Challenge is inviting post-secondary students, including Queen's University attendees, to submit innovative project proposals that could improve the quality of life for Kingston residents. Submissions, in the form of a 2 to 3 minute video, are due by March 6th, with finalists pitching to a panel of municipal and entrepreneurship leaders on March 20th. Winners may receive up to $10,000 to develop their ideas, access to the Queen's Founders and Innovators Initiative, QFII, with seed funding potential, and compete further for larger prize pools. An information session was held on February 10th in Mitchell Hall Events Commons to guide prospective entrants. Also, in athletic news, Queen's University cheerleading captured the Collegiate National Championship at the Cheer Canada Nationals on February 23, 2026, the program's first national title in 18 years. The Gaels scored 82.3 out of 100 points in a tightly contested field. Three team members were also named to the national team, highlighting individual achievements alongside the team victory. I have been Henry Walker, bringing you your Queen's Campus Beat here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Thank you for listening.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Wednesday, February 25th, daytime high of 1 degree, but it will feel a little colder, dipping into the negative range. Overnight low of minus 9. Thursday, February 26th, daytime high of minus 1, and there is a 60% chance of precipitation. Will vary between snow or rain depending on the time of day and the daytime high, overnight dropping down to minus 6. Friday, February 27th, daytime high of 3 degrees, dropping to 0 overnight, cloudy all day. Saturday, February 28th, warmest day of the week, daytime high of 5 degrees with cloudy conditions, dropping back down to minus 9 overnight. Sunday, March 1st, daytime high of minus 4 with a mix of sun and cloud. And then Monday, March 2nd, looks like we will have more winter weather in store. Daytime high of minus 8 with a 75% chance of snow flurries in the forecast. This is your City of Kingston traffic report. Just a reminder, overnight parking restrictions are in effect for the rest of February.
Come March 1st, the overnight restrictions will loosen to where overnight parking is only banned when weather conditions require it, i.e. if there is snow or freezing rain in the forecast. Until March 1st, all overnight street parking is banned in the city of Kingston.
And now it's time for the CFRC Concert and Events Calendar. On Wednesday, check out Hollow Body at Hotel Wolf Island starting at 6:30, Youngblood at the Isabel at 7, or Juliana Riolino and Cassie Velazza at Broom Factory at 7:30. Or you can also have fun with friends at Board Games Night at Something in the Water at 5, Trivia at Daft Brewing at 7, or Karaoke at the Mansion at 9. On Thursday, events and screenings kick off for the Kingston Canadian Film Festival at Broom Factory, the Isabel, Kingston Grand Theatre, and the Screening Room. Visit kingcanfilmfest.com for details and ticket information. Show highlights for Thursday include Born Ruffians at Signal Brewery at 8 o'clock, or Kells at the Broom Factory at 8:30, and also Ben Hickling at Hotel Wolf Island at the same time. There's also a burlesque show at Daft Brewing on Thursday night as well at 8 o'clock, and trivia at Riverhead, Grad Club, Something in the Water, and Queen's Pub. On Friday, CFRC's own John McClurg plays Kirkpatrick starting at 5 o'clock, and the Kingston Baroque Consort is hosting a Bach, Vivaldi, and More concert at St. James Anglican at 5:15. Miss Emily takes the stage at the Cove Inn at 7 o'clock. Dominique Fils-Aimé is at the Isabel at 7:30, and July Talk with Born Ruffians at Grand Theatre is happening at 7:30. You can also check out The Ancient Shapes, Maud Lang, and local legend Mississippi Grover at the Toucan at 10:30. On Friday, you can also check out Trivia at Wild Wing at 7 o'clock, a burlesque show at the Royal Theatre in Gananoque at 8, or karaoke at the Buckle and Daft Brewing kicking off at 9 o'clock. On Saturday, you can go see Abby Stewart at the Embassy at 7, the Big Fat Horn Band with Michael K. Myers and Debbie Feely at the RCHA at 8, Last Call, Dutch Baby, Naked by 9, and LNRK at the Mansion at 9, or Squid Pistol at the Merchant at 10 o'clock. Alongside more amazing Kingston Canadian Film Festival events and screenings, you can check out via kingcanfilmfest.com. You can also enjoy the Love Sucks Alt-Rock Drag Show at Daft Brewing at 7:30, or My Kinky Valentine Burlesque Show at The Spire at 8. And on Sunday, Tob Savage and friends are playing a weekly gig at the Kingston Yacht Club at 2 p.m. The OG Blues Band is at Spearhead at 2, and you can certainly hit up the Kingston Canadian Film Festival screenings, while the Memorial Centre Farmers Market starts at 9 o'clock in the morning, and some lovely snowshoeing opportunities are available at Little Cataraqui Conservation Area starting at 10 a.m. and for seniors at 1 p.m. Visit our concert and events calendars via CFRC.ca or check out daily posts via at CFRC Music for more concerts and events. Reach out through our website as well if you have a concert or event you'd like to share on our airwaves or through our platforms. That's a wrap for concerts and events. Back to the CFRC news team.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
We'll start with some general ways to turn ugly duckling emotions into swans. First, second,
rock, 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 rocket.
Third, this is what one doctor suggests. Number 7. Now, look forward in a positive mode. Start by spending a few minutes
each Thursday at 10 p.m. listening to Bright Side of the Pooh. What's it about? A way of life.
Number 10. Give unto others. Reach out to those you can help or inspire.
Now, it's time to flip this tape. On side two, you'll find a wonderful, calming relaxation exercise.
You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Today on Wings, the long struggle to abolish reproductive slavery.
Where is the precedent for the appropriation of a person's body by the state?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
On February 15, 2023, Professor Dorothy E. Roberts delivered the 8th annual Francis Sissy Farenthold Endowed Lecture in Peace, Justice, and Human Rights. Professor Roberts holds appointments in both law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania and is founding director of the Program on Race, Science, and Society in the Center for Africana Studies. Her talk was held at the Rothko Chapel in Houston, Texas, and was organized by the Bernard and Audrey Rappaport Center for Human Rights and Justice at the University of Texas at Austin School of Law. Here are excerpts from that talk.
In 1662, the Virginia Colonial Assembly had to decide the status of children born to black women and fathered by white men, men who raped enslaved women with impunity. The colonists made the political decision to give the children the status of their mothers. Now, this, of course, violated the patriarchal law of human inheritance, which gave children the status of their fathers. Instead, they followed the law that applied to animals. Piglets, for example, are the property of whoever owns the sow. You know, I've written about that law for a long time. I wrote about it in my very first law review article in 1991. And every time I think about it, I'm just awestruck by the magnitude of what that law did. It permitted white men to profit from raping enslaved women by enslaving any resulting children. It allowed them to enslave their own children. How could they enslave their own children? By classifying them as belonging to a different race. It erased kinship ties and helped to invent the lie that human beings are naturally divided into different races. Racism is so powerful, it can erase biology while pretending that it's biological. It allowed white men to profit from rape. And it also cemented the myth that black women's wombs are what create the disadvantage, the subordinated status of their children. I mean, just think about that. All of that is reverberating today. 2 centuries later, in 1860, Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner would point to this legal entanglement of sexual assault, reproductive control, and white supremacy as the chief reason to abolish slavery. He declared before Congress that, quote, "the chastity of a whole race is exposed to violence, while the result is recorded in the telltale faces of children, glowing with the master's blood, but doomed for the mother's skin to slavery through descending generations." Captured all those aspects in that one sentence. The rights of family were central to the antebellum movement to abolish slavery. In petitions to the government, enslaved people often based their claims for freedom on the natural right to family integrity. Abolitionists also focused their condemnation of slavery on its immoral destruction of families. Family separation was inextricably tied to reproductive servitude. Enslavers had absolute discretion to buy and sell family members separately from each other. They could dismember black families at will for whatever reason. A 19th century South Carolina court noted that planters could sell children away from their mothers no matter how young. Newborns could be taken and sold away because, quote, the young slaves stand in the same footing as other animals. According to historian, my colleague at Penn, Heather Andrea Williams, approximately one-third of enslaved children in the Upper South experience family separation. A slaveholder might sell a mother, a father, or their children to pay off a debt or to punish perceived disobedience. Black family members were devised in wills, wagered at horse races, and awarded in lawsuits. As Toni Morrison wrote in Beloved, enslaved women's loved ones routinely, quote, got rented out, loaned out, bought out, brought back, stored up, mortgaged, won, stolen, or seized. Nobody stopped playing checkers just because the pieces included your children. Even when enslaved families remained physically intact, black parents were denied authority over their children. Slavery law installed the white patriarch as the head of the extended plantation family. White people considered the plantation family ruled by white men to be the best institution to teach values to Africans, whom they deemed to be uncivilized. Law professor Peggy Cooper Davis writes, abrogation of the parental bond was a hallmark of the civil death the United States slavery imposed. Now, black mothers resisted reproductive slavery by self-inducing abortions, feigning illness, and fending off enslavers' sexual assaults. You may have read about the case of Celia, who was purchased in 1850 at age 14 by a white Missouri farmer named Robert Newsom, who bought her for the purpose of forcing sex on her, and he raped her on the way back from buying her to his farm in Missouri. After enduring 5 years of hell and pregnant with another one of his children, she clubbed him twice over the head, killing him. The judge in her murder trial instructed the jury that the law of self-defense didn't apply to chattel property. Celia was found guilty and hanged in 1855. In rare cases, as Toni Morrison fictionalized in Beloved, black women committed infanticide to protect their children from the horrors of slavery. But surely, enslaved women's greatest act of resistance was caring for their children. Yet their love for their children gave enslavers a cruel advantage. Slaveholders could threaten enslaved women who were rebellious with the sale of their children to make them more compliant. Enslavers used children as hostages to prevent bonded women from running away. Most enslaved women were unwilling to abandon their children in order to increase their own chances for escape. And most fugitive women took their children with them. So there's a long history of a white elite devaluing black mothers' relationships with their children, pretending that black women don't care about their children, while on the other hand, using the threat of child removal to control and punish black mothers because they do care for their children so much. And I'll have more to say about that later. Images of crying mothers and children clinging to each other as merciless slave traders wrenched them apart were widely circulated in anti-slavery pamphlets, slave narratives, and newspapers. The Reconstruction Congress was moved to draft the 13th and 14th Amendments, both by formerly enslaved people's heart-wrenching accounts of family separation, and by the argument that the right to family integrity is inalienable. For example, Republican Senator James Harlan of Iowa advocated for the 13th Amendment by accusing slavery of causing, quote, the abolition practically of the parental relationship, robbing the offspring of the care and attention of his parents, severing a relation which is universally cited as the emblem of the relation sustained by the Creator to the human family. His colleague, Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts, promised accordingly, quote, when this amendment to the Constitution shall be consummated, the sharp cry of the agonizing hearts of severed families will cease to vex the weary ear of the nation. But the passage of the Reconstruction Amendments didn't end reproductive slavery or the struggle against it. We can fill out the trajectory of the foundational exploitation of enslaved women's reproductive labor with the history of policies punishing Black women's childbearing throughout the 20th century.
On Wings, you are listening to excerpts from the talk titled The Long Struggle to Abolish Reproductive Slavery, delivered by Professor of Law and Sociology, Dorothy Roberts.
As I stated earlier, the first laws enacted in the colonies treated Black women as innately unrapeable and their children as innately enslavable. This laid the foundation for long-lasting notions of Black women's hypersexuality and hyperfertility and policies aimed at deterring Black women from having children. The belief that Black women passed down a depraved lifestyle to their children persisted even after the passage of the civil rights laws through the circulation of popular icons of Black maternal unfitness, such as the welfare queen, who was portrayed as having babies just to get a welfare check and then spending all the money on herself while neglecting her children, or the image of a crack addict who gave birth to the supposedly monstrous crack baby. These stereotypes were buttressed by racist scientific research, such as Daniel Patrick Moynihan's 1965 report, The Negro Family, The Case for National Action, that blamed Black matriarchs for the impoverishment of Black ghettos. This mythology fueled harsh welfare and law enforcement policies, including mass sterilization of Black women receiving welfare through federally funded social service programs. And these myths and policies are the subject of my 1997 book, Killing the Black Body. Of particular significance is the prosecution of Black women for being pregnant and using drugs, launched during the war on crack in the late 1980s. Hospital staff routinely screen certain newborns for evidence of their mother's drug use during pregnancy and report positive results to child protection authorities. Over the last 30 years, states have increasingly included prenatal drug use in their definitions of child maltreatment. The devaluation of Black women's procreation turned a public health issue into a crime. The contemporary parallels to Black women's reproductive servitude during slavery continue with forced family separation. Many Americans view the child welfare system as a benign social service provider that safeguards children from abuse and neglect in their homes. But as I explain in my latest book, Torn Apart, this government regime is better described as a family policing system. It's a powerful state apparatus that intensively regulates the most marginalized communities in this nation by accusing family caregivers of child maltreatment, investigating and monitoring them, placing their children in the foster system, and permanently severing their familial bonds. Child protection agents gain their power to regulate families by wielding the threat of taking away their children. In 2020 alone, child protection agencies investigated accusations of maltreatment involving 3 million children. In cities across the nation, CPS, or Child Protective Services, surveillance is concentrated in impoverished Black neighborhoods, where all parents, all children, are ruled by the agency's threatening presence. Most Black children in America, 53%, will experience a CPS investigation at some point before they reach age 18. Okay, most Black children in America will experience an investigation for child maltreatment before they reach age 18. During CPS investigations, caseworkers typically inspect every corner of the home, and typically without any judicial warrant. They've been exempted from the Fourth Amendment, even though it applies to them. And they interrogate family members about intimate details of their lives. They may strip search children to look for evidence and collect confidential information from schools, healthcare providers, and social service programs. More disruptive still is the forcible family separation that too often follows CPS investigations. Most of the more than $30 billion spent on child welfare services goes to keeping children away from their families in foster care and adoption assistance rather than prevention and family services. More than 1 in 10 Black children will be taken from their families by their 18th birthday. Most children in foster care were removed from their homes based on accusations of parental neglect, which is defined as failing to supply, quote, the proper or necessary support for a child's well-being. And obviously, that is easily confused with poverty. Based on state child neglect laws, child protection investigators interpret conditions of poverty, such as lack of food, insecure housing, and inadequate medical care, as evidence of parental unfitness. And what's the remedy they provide? State agents force families into an onerous regimen of supervision that rarely addresses their needs. Parents who are unable to complete agency requirements in order to recover their children from foster care within an imposed time frame face termination of their rights. A judge permanently severs their legal relationship with their children.
In this next excerpt from her talk, Professor Roberts mentions two U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Roe, which legalized abortion as a matter of privacy in 1973, and Dobbs in 2022, which denies the Constitution protects reproductive rights and leaves the matter up to individual states.
Black feminists have long argued that reproductive freedom includes both bodily and family autonomy. We have developed a reproductive justice analysis that accounts for the entanglement of abortion bans, criminalization of pregnancy, and forcible child removal. The human right not to have a child, to have a child, and to raise a child in safe, supportive, sustainable communities has always been, from the very beginning, chief tenets of the reproductive justice framework. And it's a framework that is made more urgent than ever by Dobbs. By eliminating Roe's protection of abortion before viability, which some states considered at least a limitation on fetal abuse prosecutions, Dobbs has unleashed state power to criminalize pregnant people who fail to deliver a healthy baby. Women have been arrested both for stillbirths and for attempted abortions under the same fetal protection laws. Beginning with the 2001 homicide conviction of a Black woman in Mississippi named Regina McKnight, who spent 8 years in prison until her conviction was overturned, for a stillbirth. Legal theories crafted to prosecute black women set the stage for more widespread criminalization for fetal harm. So by 2020, more than 1,700 women were arrested, detained, or subjected to forced medical interventions because of pregnancy-related outcomes and accusations. Over the same period, state legislatures enacted fetal protection laws that criminalized pregnancy by giving fetuses the status of already born children. I think we should consider the violence inflicted on black women by compelling their pregnancies under slavery to elucidate the violence inflicted on pregnant people today by compelling them to give birth under abortion bans. As historian Jennifer Morgan asked, where is the precedent for the appropriation of a person's body by the state? Where did we learn in this country that the state could define a fetus as a distinct matter of law and property and state intervention? We learned that from the long and violent history of hereditary racial slavery. Enslaved women's resistance against reproductive servitude also proves the Supreme Court's error in Dobbs. The Dobbs Court grossly misread the 14th Amendment and ignored its history by holding it provided no support for reproductive freedom. And as I already said, that was the reason, a central reason, for enacting the 13th and 14th Amendments to abolish reproductive slavery. Apparently, the court was unaware of that history. And to the contrary, the Dobbs decision will intensify the denial of family autonomy and destruction of family bonds that the Reconstruction Amendments were meant to eradicate. Especially telling is how the court's attention to adoption ties together the forms of reproductive oppression that are rooted in slavery, both compelled pregnancy and forced family separation. And during Julie Rickleman's argument on behalf of abortion clinics, Justice Amy Coney Barrett questioned, quote, insofar as you and many of you, your amici, focus on the ways in which forced parenting, forced motherhood would hinder women's access to the workplace and to equal opportunities, it's also focused on the consequences of parenting and the obligations of motherhood that flow from pregnancy. Why don't the safe haven laws take care of that problem? Now, Justice Alito picked up this idea in his majority opinion. It didn't stay at the questioning during the oral argument. He recited without any criticism anti-abortion advocates' argument, quote, that states have increasingly adopted safe haven laws which generally allow women to drop off babies anonymously, and that a woman who puts her newborn up for adoption today has little reason to fear that the baby will not find a suitable home. That's a quote from the Dobbs decision. Okay, he then backed up this false claim with a footnote that quoted a 2008 CDC report, quote, nearly 1 million women were seeking to adopt in 2002, i.e., they were in demand for a child, whereas the domestic supply of infants, this is a quote from the opinion, footnote, the domestic supply of infants relinquished at birth or within the first month of life and available to be adopted had become virtually non-existent. This vision of a well-functioning market for babies could not be further from the truth. First of all, it conveniently omits the physical and mental costs of gestating a fetus and the ethical problem of overriding pregnant people's autonomy over their bodies. The adoption market imagery falsely treats the decision to surrender the baby as if it were a freely made reproductive choice, when in reality it was coerced by the inability to get an abortion. But there's more that's so false about this baby market imagery. It terribly mischaracterizes how the adoption system operates. To begin with, the pain of losing a newborn is so severe that people who are denied an abortion rarely surrender their babies for adoption. When they were surrendered more often prior to Roe v. Wade, it was because they were forced to do it. You know, pregnant teenage girls were shipped off. It wasn't because they freely surrendered their babies for adoption. Instead, compelling people to give birth to a child whom they are economically, socially, or psychologically unprepared to raise intensifies the hardships faced by them and their families. And let's remember, will increase their odds of being deemed neglectful and becoming entangled in the family policing system. Adoption of children from foster care requires the termination of their parents' rights. The justice's promotion of adoption also ignores the untold number of what have been called legal orphans, severed from their families, but never adopted, abandoned by the state at age 18 or 21. And obviously, they're vulnerable to houselessness, poverty, and incarceration. Denying access to abortion will increase the numbers of children consigned to and spit out of the foster system without any family ties at all. We can unite the movements for reproductive justice, for prison industrial complex abolition, for abolition of the family policing system, under the banner of a shared vision of a caring and free society rather than a carceral society. We should connect activism to guarantee the legal right to abortion and all that's needed to actually be free from compelled pregnancy to the growing movement to dismantle family policing, led by parents and youth who have been ensnared in it. These activists promote legislation to end mandated reporting, to guarantee legal representation for parents, and to require informed consent for drug testing of pregnant people and their newborns. They advocate for policies that shift government funds away from coercive interventions in families toward putting resources directly in family caregivers' hands. And they are creating community-based approaches to support families and keep children safe.
Professor Dorothy E. Roberts holds appointments in both law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, and she is founding director of the Penn Program on Race, Science, and Society in the Center for Africana Studies. This Wings program was excerpted from the 8th Annual Francis Sissy Farenthold Endowed Lecture in Peace, Justice, and Human Rights. For a link to view video of the entire event, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Karen Engel, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose books include The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Mississippi Queen! And when I listen to a really good song, I start nodding my head like I'm saying yes to every beat.
Yes, 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 this rocks!
And then sometimes I switch it up like,
no! No! Don't stop a rockin'!
Every Friday morning, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. You can't possibly find it funny anymore. It's been years. Let it go.
Oh, hey, Boomer Radio Guy. You're looking pretty good. Long time no see.
Stack them eights, yo-yo. Feel free to let your tongue down and hammer away with words that make you feel good.
Okay, well, I'm not really sure what that means, but now that I've seen you, I wanted to tell you, I got my own radio show. It's on Saturday mornings from 8 until 10. It's called Making Bacon.
Hey, Beaver, the...